This is the crisis point. Welcome to the Crisis Point podcast, where, like G.K. Chesterton, we discuss nothing except for politics and religion because, well, there's nothing else to discuss. I am your host, Michael Warren Davis, the editor of Crisis Magazine, and as always, I am joined by Philip F. Lawler, the director of the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture at the Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, and we are very grateful to you all for joining us. The bombshell topic of this podcast, of course, is the McCarrick Report. How could it be anything else? It's about 150,000 words, about 460 pages in PDF, and it's relieved all of Phil's concerns. He is now very supportive of the Francis Vatican and has recanted of all of his criticism. So this is a great day for the church, isn't it, Phil?
Not exactly.
Why not?
Well, the report is, frankly, it's part of the cover-up. That may be a harsh way to put it, but this report doesn't tell us any, it doesn't answer any of the important questions that we had that were raised that prompted Pope Francis to promise a thorough investigation. Mm-hmm. It gives us a lot of details confirming mostly what we already know. There's very little, there's a great deal of detail, but there's very little headline news here. Some newspapers have managed to make headlines out of things that were known to anybody who is watching this story already.
Right.
It does not tell us what we need to know. And it's hard for me to avoid the conclusion. In fact, I don't avoid the conclusion that it's a case of damage control. It's meant to It's meant to give us the impression that this has been thoroughly researched, thoroughly investigated, without the reality of an investigation that turns up what we need to know.
So what would you expect out of a thorough report? If this was a serious document, and what would you expect it to say?
Well, my immediate response, I expected roughly what we got.
Okay.
What I would want, what mm-hmm. I would demand if I were in charge of this investigation, is a report that explained why McCarrick was promoted through the ranks, how he handled his influence, how he influenced Vatican decisions, particularly in the appointment of other bishops, mm-hmm. which bishops supported him as he rose through the ranks, and which of the bishops that he supported, because as far as I'm concerned, all of those bishops should now be viewed with at least a little bit of suspicion.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate, or at least maybe Francis's advocate. And because this is a very confusing topic for those of us who don't spend all day sort of in the weeds of Vatican politics. So the report, I think at one point does say, yes, you know, Pope Francis would occasionally respond to McCarrick's letters, but there is no evidence that he had any influence over the appointment of bishops. So why is that not true? Why do we know that that's not true?
It's very hard to know things. That's one of the disadvantages of working as a journalist covering the Vatican.
Yes.
The classic expression of the frustration is those who tell don't know, and those who know don't tell.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But it was commonly acknowledged for years that McCarrick was the kingpin in the United States, that he was the most important prelate in choosing other prelates. Mm-hmm. If you look at the roster now, you see several who were his friends, his mm-hmm. allies, who have risen through the ranks. Cardinal Supish in Chicago, mm-hmm. Cardinal Tobin in Newark, to a large extent, Cardinal Wuerl in Washington.
Who is still on the Congregation for Bishops, or just resigned, I think.
He's off, I believe, as of Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
So tomorrow, that is, as we speak. So, but put it this way, he was very, very well connected. Everybody in Rome thought he was the man to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Bishop, when you say Pope Francis did not talk to him about the appointment of bishops. That's not surprising. The Pope generally doesn't talk to anybody about the appointment of bishops other than the prefect of the Congregation for Bishops. But that doesn't mean that other cardinals can't influence the choices that are presented to the Pope.
Right, right. One of the things that I was really shocked by, I guess I shouldn't have been, but was the arrogance with which then Cardinal McCarrick addressed himself to officials in the Vatican. So when Pope Benedict handed down his quote unquote recommendations or his restrictions to Cardinal McCarrick through, I think it was Cardinal Ray. And so McCarrick writes back and says, okay, I'll do that. But just to clarify, you know, this appointment is ad personam. So I'm going to plan on continuing to do that. And of course, I'm indispensable to these conferences for peace in the Holy Land. So I'm going to continue to attend those as well. When he had been told, you know, cancel all of your international travel, step down from all of your appointments, and don't come to Rome unless you have express permission from the Pope. He totally ignored all of those, but he was even, you know, the way that those recommendations should have been enforced or whether anyone even expected them to be enforced, that's another question. But you know, he wasn't even just sort of sneaking around behind the Vatican's back and going to Jerusalem and China. He was basically telling to them to their face, you know, yeah, I'll agree to this, but I'm not going to actually do it. Just so you're aware. And the other thing that really, really struck me was the early 2000s when these letters began circulating among the U.S. bishops saying that warning everyone that McCarrick was too intimate with seminarians and that he was going to cause a major scandal. And McCarrick writes to Cardinal O'Connor and says, I just want you to know that I'm going to be referring these letters to any, this is almost a verbatim quote because I was so struck by it, quote, our friends in the FBI and local police. So he was using his pull to the extent that he had any pull in law enforcement to try to, you know, silence his critics, presumably would have accused them of slander or calumny and probably scared a lot of them into silence. Again, it was just the flagrant kind of mafia don attitude that he took to all of these things.
Yeah, it's a topic that isn't much discussed in this report and that's worth discussing, would have been worth discussing, is how it was that, as you say, Cardinal McCarrick, or then Cardinal McCarrick, was given a directive to withdraw from public life, and he didn't. Hmm. He was extraordinarily active. He was flying all over the world, giving speaking appearances and so forth. And who was to enforce the directive? Was it Cardinal Ray? Well, he had a whole lot of other things on his mind. Was it the papal nuncio, Archbishop Vigano? Well, he was outranked, and he knew he was outranked by Cardinal McCarrick. He knew that this man had much more clout than he did. He had seen the correspondence that McCarrick had with the Vatican, the correspondence to which you refer, where McCarrick said, well, of course, they can't afford to lose me here. And of course, it's essential to the world's welfare that I go there. And so who was going to enforce it? Yeah. It was a power play.
Yeah. I want to know the whole story with Archbishop Vigano, because the McCarrick report, for those who haven't read it, alleges that he was ordered by the Congregation for Bishops to, so let's backtrack. When Archbishop Vigano, as U.S. nuncio, which is basically the papal ambassador to the United States, when he was told about the McCarrick scandal that was brewing, he went to the Congregation for Bishops, as he should, as is sort of normal procedure. Now, the McCarrick report says that the Congregation for Bishops ordered him to investigate this witness or this victim, who the report names as Priest 3, as well as some of his superiors in the diocese that he where he was living, probably Metuchen or Newark or DC. The report says that they spoke to Priest Three and his superiors and never heard from Archbishop Vigano. Again, I mean, I'm not impugning anything on Archbishop Vigano, but I'm very curious to see his next statement, because I wonder how he's going to respond to that, because he's named many times in the document, but the McCarrick report basically says it's Vigano's fault because he didn't follow through on any of the on the investigation. He didn't dig up what was actually going on. He didn't give any evidence to the Vatican that would be considered actionable. And that's a huge, huge allegation. And again, we really can't say very much more about the McCarrick report until we hear his side of the story.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to have to differ with you there. It looks, from what I read in the McCarrick report, it looks as if Archbishop Vigano dropped the ball here. And I, like you, I'm anxious to see what he says about that, and I suspect we'll hear from him pretty quickly. But if he did, he just joins a very long list of people who dropped the same ball over a period of years. The difference is that Archbishop Vigano, well, there are two differences. First, Archbishop Vigano has acknowledged that he dropped the ball after the fact. He has said that he wished he'd been more forthright in earlier years. And second, he's one of the people who is featured in this report as having warned about McCarrick at least twice, mm-hmm. when he was working in the Vatican in 2006 and 2008. And so it's revealing that he comes off in this report as the bad guy. There are plenty of bad guys, most of them conveniently dead, by the way, and unable to defend themselves. And I think the focus on Archbishop Vigano is unfair and misleading.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that's true. Yeah. George Weigel released an article or a statement today talking about John Paul II. And this is a very difficult time for John Paul's legacy, because a lot of people have been putting the blame on him for the sex abuse crisis. As you just said, it's foolish and irresponsible to blame any one person for the crisis, but he's become the center of a lot of this attention. And George Weigel says that John Paul was manipulated and lied to by McCarrick and a lot of the people around him. Do you think, what's your take on that, Phil?
He was certainly manipulated. Look, one of the things that comes out in this report is that McCarrick successfully conned Pope John Paul II into appointing him as Archbishop of Washington, even after some damaging reports had reached the Vatican. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly how much of the detail of those reports found its way to Pope John Paul himself. They may have been filtered. This report gives you a very clear picture of how much was filtered before it got to any one of the popes who were involved in this whole sequence of events. Mm-hmm. But we also know that Pope John Paul was inclined to disbelieve stories about priestly misbehavior or misbehavior by bishops, because he had seen in his years in the Soviet Union how the communist has used that sort of rumor to stain the names of Catholic priests, and particularly those who opposed the regime. Mm. So he was vulnerable to that sort of suasion. And McCarrick was a very good con artist, and he convinced Pope John Paul that these reports were unfounded, these rumors were unfounded. He wasn't the only one. There's also the case of Father Maciel, who apparently convinced Pope John Paul that the rumors about him were also unfounded. So Yes, it's true. This is one of those things we've known for a while, that Pope John Paul was a wonderful leader. He was a saint, but he was not perfect. And we have known that he was vulnerable to this sort of con game. So, okay, it's repeated here. And to place the blame on him is, of course, a way of deflecting the blame from people who are still alive.
Yes, that's certainly a big part of it. I do, and I'm afraid of making myself a little unpopular on this particular episode of the podcast, but I do just want to say, and you can or may not respond to this, Phil. But you know, I'm always weary of saying that, you know, Pope John Paul was a great leader, but he had this, he was not always a very good judge of character. Now, couldn't the same thing be said about Benedict and Francis? Couldn't we, it's not excusable in John Paul, but it is not something that we feel makes him, doesn't sort of damn his memory. But there are a lot of, I've noticed, especially Catholics that lean towards traditionalism, who are very, very down on Pope Benedict now because of the McCarrick thing, largely. And obviously the same about Pope Francis. So is it possible that all three popes were, to one extent or the other, just sort of duped and, again, just failed in their judgment of his character?
I don't think you can say they're all duped. I think I would blame Pope Benedict also, not for being duped, because eventually he figured out, he seems to have come to the conclusion that these reports he was hearing were true. And he was fairly hard-headed in the case, for instance, of Father Maciel, who's in fact very, very hard-headed in that case, once he became convinced. And it was Pope Benedict who decided that McCarrick should resign, and decided that rather quickly. It didn't come about very quickly.
Yes.
But the Pope made the decision pretty quickly. Where I would fault him is that he didn't follow up. And that does seem to have been a characteristic flaw of his, that he had, he didn't crack the whip.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think you can fault all three popes. And I think with Pope Francis, you can say he has been very good at promising prompt action and promising to root out this corruption. But we haven't seen a whole lot of action to back up those promises. And I see this report as more of the same.
Yeah. To Pope Francis's credit, he did defrock McCarrick eventually. And I think it's worth noting that when eventually he was defrocked, it was for some very old accusations, decades old accusations, that where there was only the witness's testimony. Now that's in contrast to the later, the Beach House stories, where several seminarians and priests say that they witnessed the inappropriate behavior. They're also much more recent. The difference, of course, is that the earlier stories that they eventually hung McCarrick with were about abuse of minors, whereas the newer, more numerous, more easily corroborated stories were about, the abuse of men generally in their early to mid 20s. I'm going to make myself very unpopular here, but Francis ended up defrocking McCarrick on a much lower standard of evidence than would hold up in the U.S. in a U.S. court, for instance. That's right and just, because the Catholic Church is a monarchy. It's not a republic. We don't have the Anglo-American jurisprudential tradition in the Catholic Church. It seems to me that there was this long period where there were all these rumors circulating about McCarrick, eminently believable rumors, and I'm sure more believable to anyone who'd met him, because, again, every word that you read that he wrote to these Vatican officials makes him sound like a thug, a very, very slippery character. But still, these are largely rumors. And the other detail that I was struck by, and again, a thug that was ready to call the police if anyone, you know, tried to pin any of this to him. And then I was also struck by the fact that the first person who went on the record in the, I think it was the middle 2010s, maybe it might have been even a little bit earlier, this guy that they're calling Priest Number One, the way that he came forward and gave his testimony, according to the report, is that he went to his bishop, his ordinary, and said, "I've molested two underage boys." And then the ordinary says, where did this come from? And so the guy says, you know, well, when I was a seminarian, I was touched inappropriately by Bishop McCarrick. And so the Vatican, obviously in retrospect, was wrong to do this, but the Vatican treated him as an unreliable witness. They didn't shift their investigation and investigate McCarrick. They only investigated this particular priest, and he was probably eventually defrocked. But again, so there was for decades and decades, there were all these rumors of that McCarrick was a predator, you know, either, you know, principally of young men, but it, you know, and but again, it's there was a low that a high standard of evidence made it very difficult for them to nail him. And then eventually it seems to me like Pope Francis, when the child abuse accusations came out, it seems to me like Pope Francis just said, all right, let's just get rid of him. I mean, he didn't even appear at his own trial. He didn't give testimony at his own canonical trial. They just threw him out the window. And again, I mean, they should have done more to that point, but yeah, when the shoe dropped, it dropped.
Yeah, it's the frustration that one feels reading this report is how the rumors mount and mount and mount. And it's in the nature of these charges that there's never going to be videotape. Mm-hmm. There aren't going to be eyewitnesses. It's going to be, hearsay evidence or the testimony of one victim. And so it's always deniable. But when you keep hearing the rumors and you keep hearing them, and finally it reaches the point where you say, there's so much smoke, there's got to be fire.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
While we're talking about rumors, bear in mind that this is Vatican's decisions and the decisions of bishops in this country and of the apostolic nuncio who's representing the Pope in this country. They're all made against the background of rumors that were circulating widely, not only among bishops and priests, but among journalists. Yeah. I distinctly recall being asked by one journalist from a leading newspaper if I was aware that there was a scandal involving the Archbishop of a major American see that could come to light any minute. Yeah. And I said, yes, I know who you're talking about. And it was very clearly McCarrick.
Yeah.
In the year 2010, according to the report, Cardinals George and Wuerl were expressing concerns to the Vatican about, and I quote, "the possibility that the New York Times is going to publish a nasty article already prepared about the Cardinal's moral life." Times already had something prepared. That's in 2010,
yeah,
8 years before this came to light. So you're right, the standard of evidence would not be sufficient to secure conviction in American court, at least not from what we know. But a prudent man understands what's happening.
Oh, for sure. Oh, absolutely. And I don't mean to give the impression otherwise, you know, and that jogs my memory because when the McCarrick thing first started to break in 2018, I remember Ross Douthat published a column in the New York Times, and I don't think he named his employer, but he said, "I know for a fact that there were journalists who knew about McCarrick, but refused to run the story because they were afraid of outing him as a gay man in a conservative homophobic institution." It could very well have been the New York Times. That could very well be why that New York Times story that you just mentioned, Phil, never ended up being run. But you know, if we talk about complicity in the Catholic Church, we have to talk about complicity in the liberal media, because there's no doubt whatsoever that a lot of these people in the media knew about Cardinal McCarrick and could have acted much sooner, but they waited until they had a legal minor to come forward, not because they care about McCarrick's victims, but because they wanted to hang the Catholic Church on that testimony. If they cared about justice, they would have come forward long, long ago with what they knew. And that can be said for everyone who knew about McCarrick. But I think it needs to be said that that the liberal media, that much of what we know about the McCarrick scandal is part of a hit job by the liberal media against the Catholic Church. They don't care about the victims of Cardinal McCarrick. If they did, they would have acted a long time ago. They care about bringing down the Catholic Church.
Right. And for that purpose, it's actually better for them to have a cardinal subject to blackmail than to have a cardinal in disgrace. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why the story about him didn't come out in 2002. I think there were threats to out him then. And the people making those threats realized that it's the sort of threat that's more powerful in the threatening than in the carrying through.
Yeah. Now, I don't think we could finish this podcast without mentioning that you read the whole report, didn't you, Phil?
I'm closing in on the end, yes.
So you've already read the bit about the KGB.
Yeah.
That was extraordinary. So I hope our listeners, I think we're going to run a story about it, I think, Friday. We have Elizabeth Yor, who's going to do a piece for us. So at one point, I don't remember what year it was, Phil. Why don't you tell the story?
Oh, you'd better, because that...
Okay. I can't remember exactly what year it was, but the KGB allegedly approached Cardinal McCarrick about becoming an asset. This is obviously in the 80s or the very early 90s, probably the 80s. And then I think the FBI contacted him after that and said, will you be a double agent? We know that you were approached. So will you turn evidence and become a double agent in the KGB? The Vatican report, the McCarrick report, says that there's no evidence that he continued that relationship at all. But it certainly rose a red flag for me when I saw him talk about his friends at the FBI. How did he make those friends at the FBI? Was it by being a double agent or a triple agent? Because it certainly puts his activity with China in a new perspective. The idea that a Catholic cardinal, and for those who don't know, Cardinal McCarrick was instrumental in the Vatican's concordat with China. And if you're baffled by the fact that a Catholic bishop would even consider a power-sharing agreement with the People's Republic of China, consider for a moment that he might have been a Soviet asset. And that sort of changes things a little bit in my mind.
It's interesting. I had a different reaction to that, not contradictory at all, maybe complimentary. I said to myself, why did the KGB approach him? Why did the KGB try to recruit him?
Good question.
Is it not very likely that the KGB knew what so many other people knew? And they thought he had a weakness. He was blackmailable. And therefore, they thought that they would be able to control him.
Fascinating. I honestly hadn't even thought of that. That's a great question. I'm going to follow up on that. Very interesting. It's also sort of interesting that the U.S. government, presumably the U.S. government, would have then known, and obviously they didn't take any particular interest in the fact that he was seducing seminarians or trying to. That's the other thing, and I don't want to end this on a low note. I guess the whole thing is kind of a low note, but one of the things that was very painful for me was reading the descriptions of his advances, if you want to call it that, the way that he would touch young men in public, at dinners in full view of everyone, and people that saw it saying, the poor kid looked like a deer in headlights. He had no idea what to do, and McCarrick just wouldn't stop. And I don't want to get too lurid. I mean, if you read the report, it's all there. But I mean, this was a, as bad as what he, you know, as bad as he was, he's also just really, really gross. And, you know, you can abstract it and say that this is a cardinal, this is a bishop who was sexually abusing seminarians, young priests, possibly altar boys, etc. But when you actually read the descriptions, it's really, really ugly. It's uglier than you even imagine, and you already imagine it's pretty ugly. Again, it's just, it makes it very, very difficult to believe that, you know, he's doing this in a crowded room, the Skeeve, and how did people not know about it? It's just, it's impossible. It's manifestly impossible.
Right. I think that's one of the things that I wanted to see addressed. If I was aware of this around the year 2000, 18 years before it came out, how many bishops, how many priests were aware of it? The grapevine works pretty efficiently. When I hear bishops saying that they were close to McCarrick, but they just didn't know, I just can't believe it.
Mm.
But can I toss something in? Because as you say, you don't want to end on a low note.
Can I put in one more low note first?
Okay.
The thing that I wasn't very aware of Cardinal McCarrick when I became a Catholic in 2016, because he was already kind of out of the way. But when the first reports broke, the thing that I noticed first was his nose. He's got his red nose. He's clearly an alcoholic. And the report confirms that. The report talks, every witness always says that he's drunk and he was slurring his speech and he was sloppy. And I don't know how that wasn't a red flag either, because it was immediately obvious to me, as it should be to everyone, that this is a guy who had a serious drinking problem. And that should have raised a red flag for more people in itself. Again, not that alcoholics are all by any means sexual predators, but if you hear reports about sexual predation from a man who is, you know, constantly drunk in public, makes a huge scene, and is clearly, it's so frequent that it actually affects the way that he looks, that the evidence just piles up and it becomes unignorable. But anyway, Phil, please continue.
I just wanted to say that reading this report, one of the things I did not know was Cardinal O'Connell, late Cardinal O'Connell of New York, is one of the few American bishops who comes off pretty well in this report.
Yes.
That early on, he was a supporter of McCarrick. He heard the rumors. He got the anonymous letters. He didn't pay a whole lot of attention to them, as you shouldn't to an anonymous letter.
Mm-hmm.
But he did, I think, take note of them and gradually became more concerned, so that by 1999, he was expressing reservations. And by the year 2000, he was warning the Vatican that this man should not be Archbishop of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the few who didn't sugarcoat it, who didn't make an effort to excuse behavior that was obviously a sign of a problem. He didn't try to talk it away. He was blunt about it. So I was pleased to see that. I've always admired Cardinal O'Connor, and I thought he was a straight shooter, and he was in this case.
Yeah, there are a couple of, I'm probably going to name the wrong one, so I don't want to guess, but there were a couple of bishops that were actually quite dogged in trying to get him exposed, and it was a little patches of light in an otherwise dark sky, you know, slogging through all of that text. So yeah, thanks for bringing that up, and we should I think end on that note, because it is good to know that that there are still good men in the hierarchy, and they need our support very, very badly. But I'm afraid that's all the time that we have for this week. As always, we're very grateful to you for joining us, and we look forward to speaking to you again next week. Until then, I am Michael Warren Davis, he is Philip F. Lawler, and this is The Crisis Point. Thank you all again so much, and God bless you.